This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Sarah will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage on any controversy, either endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Daniel will read the steps.
I'm Daniel, I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Excuse me. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jenny will read the traditions.
My name's Jenny. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, our loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA has such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Arissa.
Thank you. My name is Arissa, and I am a very grateful recovered alcoholic. It is so nice to be with you guys here tonight. What a pocket of enthusiasm. What a joy to see all of these old faces and friends. The date of my last drink was October the 13th, 1993. And for that, I am eternally grateful. And to tell you a little bit what it was like for me, I started drinking young and I quit drinking young. But in that small little period of time, I managed to like hit the moon about 3 times. I'm the kind of girl who doesn't notice that she drank the whole bottle of Jack Daniels. It just kind of happened when I wasn't looking. You ever do things behind your own back? I do a lot of things behind my own back under the influence of alcohol. I have one, and that's all I think I'm having. And then the next thing I know, somebody's carrying me home. I pass out in other people's showers. I sleep in their dog houses. I did. I was so upset that they thought I was in there. They kept trying to get me to come out. How could they think I would be in there to begin with? I would never. Well, okay, I'm there, you know. And when I got to AA the first time, I was 17 years old, and I needed to be here. But the secret about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's not for people who need it. It's for people who want it. And the truth was, I was voted most likely to succeed, class president, class favorite, accepted into one of the best universities in the country, and I did not get the unmanageability part at all. I read the big book, because they gave me one, and I read about the potential alcoholic, and I read about the man of 30, you know who I'm talking about, the one who, you know, stops drinking on his own and goes and has this career. And then he's dead within like 3 years when he does retire and starts drinking. And I found hope in that story. I was like, that's me. Yeah, so smart girl that I am, I know I'm going to need this big book. So I take it with me to college, pack it in my little suitcase, put it backwards on the shelf so that nobody can read the binding. But I know I'm going to need it one day. So I never get rid of it. That is until I passed it on to a drunk light later on when I didn't have another big book to give them. I don't still have that big book. But I kept it through 3.5 years of college. And what happened was I tried not to drink. And I was a woman with a lot of sobriety. I was so dry. It was ugly. It was really ugly. And I did a lot of therapy. And that's really good if you don't have alcoholism. You know, it doesn't work on alcoholism. That's the problem. And I did a lot of yoga, and that's really good, but it doesn't work on alcoholism. I did Pilates back in the day before nobody did Pilates. And it's really great, but it doesn't work on alcoholism. And I had a soul sickness. So I went to Brazil, because that's a really spiritual place. And Brazil's a really wonderful place, and I swam with the piranhas in the Amazon. And that's a wonderful thing to do if you don't care about your life, because I didn't. And these are all wonderful things to do if you want to get spiritual, but it doesn't treat alcoholism. So now I'm a girl who's taken a lot of religion classes, a lot of yoga, a lot of Pilates, a lot of therapy, and I've been up the Amazon, and I still have alcoholism, and I don't know it. And I'm really miserable. And the truth is, I want to die, you know? And I had prayers like, because I hadn't completely given up on God. I had prayers like, God, please just don't let me wake up in the morning. You know? And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And the grace of God came into my life, and I picked up a drink. Doesn't sound right, does it? But you see, alcohol's my solution. It kept me alive so many times when I was ready to drive off the end of the cliff. I grew up in Texas, right on the water, banana trees in the backyard, palm trees in the front yard, and there was a great cliff with this drive, you know, a T-junction. You know, I would sit at the light, and I'd just... 1976 Cadillac, and I wanted to floor it over the edge. I mean, Thelma and Louise wasn't out yet, but that was the moment, you know? Like, I'm waiting, like, you know, somebody robbed my dream. But anyway, I didn't want to be me. And I picked up a drink again after coming back from the Amazon, and it took a little bit of the edge off. And I should tell you that when I was in the Amazon, I broke my wrist, and I'm a right-handed artist, and I'm a cast from fingertip to shoulder, and so I can't drive my stick shift. I can't go back to college because I'm, like, an artist. And, you know, thank you. And I'm back in my parents' house. And you see, I thought I drank because of them. Because if you grew up where I grew up, you'd be drinking too. You know, I come from a long line of missionaries on one side and adult child of an alcoholic on the other. It's not pretty in my house, you know? It's just not. There's a whole lot of God and a whole lot of violence. And that made Alcoholics Anonymous hard in the beginning. You know, but what happened was I woke up with alcohol poisoning again after 3.5 years. And I asked myself, what the hell happened? You know, oops, sorry. I didn't know what had happened, and I was at my mom's house, and I went downstairs, and I was like, Mom, what's wrong with me? I don't do this anymore. And she didn't know what was wrong with me. And I was going to therapy later that day, because I'm still in therapy. And I she had to drive me to therapy, because I'm still drunk. I got home at midnight, and I'm still drunk, and it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm still drunk. And I look at my therapist, and I'm like, do you think I could be an alcoholic? And she says, no. Mm-mm. I think you might have a little drinking problem. I don't think you're an alcoholic. What do you do if you just have a little drinking problem? Anytime I pick up a drink, but I don't have alcoholism, you know? And I cried from the depths of my soul. And what happened was she put me in touch with somebody in AA, and that began my journey. And when I walked into that next meeting, oh my goodness, I was home. You guys spoke my language. I heard for the first time everything I'd been looking for all over the world. You know, and I chase sobriety. I still chase sobriety. When I walked in, I was lucky to walk into a group not so big as this, but fundamentally the same. You know, take the cotton out of your ears, honey, and put it in your mouth. You got to learn to listen if you're going to listen to learn. Yes, ma'am. You know, and it wasn't Peggy that was there, but it was somebody just like Peggy, you know, and she'd been sober a long time, and she had, no offense, I'm not meaning physically, the big Texas hair and the long nails, and she'd flip them together, you know. I don't mean your hairstyle, you know that. Anyway, and I was too afraid to talk to her, but I would overhear what she was saying to her sponsees, and I would do everything she said for her sponsees to do, you know. I was too afraid to get right up close to it. But I got a sponsor who was still pretty strict, and they told me that if I didn't work the steps right away, I was going to get drunk again, and I was going back to college, and I believed her. And so at 2.5 months, I worked my first, fourth, and fifth step, you know, and I stayed in this work ever since. Like, I don't want to drink again. I don't want that life. What's worse than drinking again is living in sobriety. You know, I believe in these steps. I believe in this book. This book has changed and saved my life. I didn't want my life. It's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I have gone through so much in these 16 years. I can't even begin to tell you. But one thing that has been a constant is Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just the fellowship, the work. I work with a lot of women, and I go through the steps religiously. You know, I recommit myself to the steps on a regular basis. I just finished going through an 8-step. I am in the middle of doing a 9-step. I just did another 4th and 5th. I mean, I believe in doing it over and over and over again, you know. I can't stay sober on last year's work. It's just not in me. I believe that God's got to get bigger every single day of my life. You know, that's what I believe. I believe that God speaks through you people. And it's the new person. Wherever you are in the back of the room, you're the person that's going to save my life. And if I'm not talking to you, then there's no hope for me. Thank you. And, you know, I found God in these rooms, and I didn't want to find God. And what I found out most about God was that God's crazy about me. I thought he hated me, but God's crazy about me, you know? And I get to be one of God's kids. And I'm connected to you guys on a spiritual level, you know? And it's just the most beautiful thing in the world. If you're new, and this sounds like nothing you want, just hang on. Keep your seat. Don't drink and get a sponsor who works the steps. And I promise you, if you do what this book says, that one day the moment will come when there won't be anybody on earth that you'd rather be than you. That's my reality today. Thanks for my sobriety.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Rick.
Thank you. Ah, come on. Hi, my name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. My sober date is January 10th, 1981. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group in Chelsea, Riverside. My sponsor is Rich G, and I'm working 9, 10, 11, and 12. Wow. It's listening to Arissa. I came in, and I haven't had a drink since. But I, not only am I a beginner like everybody else every day as a new beginning, but I really am, I really feel like a beginner, and I'll tell you why as I go on. I had my first drunk when I was 16. I was in a Franciscan seminary, and I was home for the summer. And my buddies said, let's go over to the mansion on the 4th of July. Now, I was 16 years old. The mansion was a bar and a restaurant where I had been to dinner with my family. And I went home and asked my mother, I said, Mama, is it all right? The guys want to go over to the mansion on the 4th of July. Is it all right if I go? My mother said, pause. You watch out for yourself. So that was a yes. So I went. So the group of us, which included my best friend and a cousin I had spent every summer of my life with, and we stood up at the bar, and the first round was offered a shot of Philadelphia Rye and a beer chaser. The second round was offered. At the third round, somebody said, you all ready? And both my cousin and my best friend said, I've had enough. I was embarrassed. I really was embarrassed that these guys said they had enough. So I went on drinking. And I got loaded. I don't know if I blacked out. I don't remember how I got home. But I know the next morning was Sunday. And they woke me up. Somebody woke me up and said, what mass are you going to? I usually went to the 11. But this morning I said, the 1 o'clock. I felt terrible. But I said, 1 o'clock. And then I realized what I had been hearing all my childhood and youth on Sunday mornings when somebody stayed over or when my brothers went out. They always said, 1 o'clock. And I thought, now I know what they were doing. And now I belong to the group. Now I'm an adult. Also at the bar, drinking with my buddies who were all straight, and I'm gay, and I thought this was the first time that I was doing something with men that men did and I could do. So I had to double rite of passage on that first drunk. Anyway, I drank, and slowly it progressed. And by the time I was in college, I was still drinking, but only on occasion, only when the guys drank. But always I drank as much as there was. I never turned down a drink. And then, it kept progressing. I went into theater. I became an actor. I'm going to fast forward. We get to 1975. And I'm in a Broadway show. I'm an understudy, and I'm part of the ensemble, they call it. It's like chorus boys who don't dance or sing. And during the show, when I wasn't on stage, I went up to my dressing room, and I shared with two other actors, and one of them was at his dressing table closing the drawer on a bottle of gin or vodka. And I thought to myself, my God, he's drinking during the show. You don't do that. Have one drink before the show and then do what you want afterward. That show closed after a week. And then I was doing an off-Broadway show in which I played two parts. I played a very important part in the first act, and in the second act I played a tiny part. Well, when the first act was over, I had died in the first act. When it was over, I said, well, I did my work. And all I do is come on and say three words in the second act. So I would sneak around the corner, get two cans of Ballantine ale, and chug-a-lug. I'd done my job. I wasn't drinking during performance. Months later, I started working at the Irish Arts Center, where there was a lot of drinking. And I did a number of shows there. And after being there about a year and a half or 2 years, one of the shows had a very important part. And I used to come in with two cans of Ballantine ale and put them right on my dressing table. And I'd drink through the performance. So that's how things progressed. In 1978, I was told that I had alcoholic hepatitis, so I didn't stop drinking. I'd die. And I thought this was great. Now I have a reason to stop drinking. I didn't know I wanted to stop drinking. Anyway, after 3 months of not drinking, I wanted to die. I didn't like life. Anyway, I didn't, because I got mugged with a knife at my throat. And I decided that I wanted to live, and I got out of that situation. The progression got worse. 1975, I went to my first meeting, and I decided that these people were sicker than I was. It was Perry Street. So I left and said, yeah, I'm going to get a drink. So I did. And I drank for 6 more years. Then at the end of the 6 years, things were really getting not nice, not good. I mean, I had things happen, you know, but it was the inside. It was slowly dying, drying up, crumbling. And one time I was helping a friend clean up after his New Year's bash, and we had breakfast to start. And on the third martini, he said, let's get up and get some work done. And I got up, and I stumbled, knocked something over, and I bent to pick it up. And from behind me, I heard his voice say, Rick, you're drunk. You can't do anything. I turned around. I heard it. I turned around. I said, you're right. I'm going home. And I didn't know what to do. But I ran into a friend of mine right at the top of the stairs in my building who had been 12-stepping me for 3.5 years. And without thought, I said, John, take me to a meeting. He did. And after the first meeting, he said, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to get a drink. And he said, And I said, John, I need a drink. He said, okay. So we went home. He lived in the apartment behind me. And we had coffee. He asked me, do you want to come in for coffee? And I said, yes. First time I ever let a drink wait. I went in, we had coffee, and then I asked to go to another meeting. I went to another meeting, and I've been going to meetings ever since. I didn't want to drink after that second meeting, and it was just lifted, gone. Now, fast forward, I got a sponsor. I had a home group. I did service. I did coffee. I was the secretary. I did literature. I did exchange meetings and a number of other things. I did my fifth step at 5 years. I'm running out of time. Anyway, I did my fifth step then. And when I was 12 years sober, I asked my sponsor to do the 12 steps with me. And he said he couldn't. And I started looking for a 12-step sponsor. And luckily, I ended up with someone who was a member here. And he became my sponsor. Now, he introduced me to the Big Book. I had read the Big Book, in the first week when I came in. But I had never looked at it again. And the amazing things that have happened since I've worked with him and done the 12 steps. I was never happy being sober. I wasn't so bad, but I was never happy. But now I am happy. And I'm finishing this. I mean, I'm doing all 12 steps now. And I have you to thank. I have especially AG, my sponsor, and all of you. The welcome that you first gave me when I came here, I still get it from you, and that means so much. Thank you.
And our main speaker tonight is Kelly.
Hi, my name is Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. I feel much less qualified to speak as opposed to the speakers before me. You had so much more time. My sober date is 9999, so I just celebrated 10 years. And thank you. And it was really good to hear people who have walked before me speak before me, so that was really exciting. And I've been a member of the Atlantic Group since day 10 of my sobriety. So I basically grew up in this group, and I'm going to cry. I don't know why. It's just going to happen, and so deal with it. So on day 10 of my sobriety, I came to Atlantic Group, and yeah, this is where I grew up. Thank you. So Arisa was my first sponsor and took me through, you know, a lot of my sobriety. It'll go away. You know, Arisa was my very first sponsor. I met, I'll start from the beginning. Stephanie met me for my very first meeting in New York. And Stephanie met me on 86th and Broadway and took me to my first meeting in New York. And I can't look at them. And it took me to my first meeting in New York, and I went. It was a women's meeting, and then Arisa I met 7 days later, and I asked her to sponsor me right away. And as you see what Arisa looks like. I heard her speak, and she looked like an angel to me. Like everything she said, you know, when they talk about finding a sponsor who has what you want. Gina, who has what you want. And when I heard Arisa speak, she talked about how she got through all of these different things in sobriety. And they were pretty terrible things, I have to say. Like, I mean, I felt bad. I did. They were, I mean, like, I hope she'll talk about this, but like, she's an artist and she works with smoke and canvas, and her whole entire masters got burned down in a fire. And she had a happy smile on her face. you know, and she was talking about how wonderful her life was. And I'm like, all right, I have to have this woman as my sponsor, because if she can feel good about that, then she can get me through anything. So, you know, I heard her speak, and she had this wonderful quality about her, and I needed to have what she had. And so I went to her and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, well, let's talk about it. And that crushed me. I was like, wait a minute. I was used to getting what I wanted. Or, you know, I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted her to say yes. I didn't want her to reject. You know, I was really nervous about that. But before I go into all of that, I'll tell you a little bit more about my background. But, you know, the reason why I feel emotional about this group is just because, like I said, I grew up here. You know, I mean, I got to do so many beautiful things in my sobriety, and I continue to do so many beautiful things. And I feel like they're a result of being a member of this group and of having so many beautiful people who I got to follow in their footsteps. So I started drinking when I was 14, my first drunk. I got completely drunk, and my parents were out of town. My mom's here, by the way, to hear me speak, and she's heard this before, so I'm not going to say. So I got the first time I picked up a drink, I blacked out. I was completely blacked out. I don't remember anything, and I ended up throwing scissors at my friend. My friend only had a few drinks, and I drank till oblivion. You know, I was completely blacked out. And I woke up, puked the next day, said I'd never do it again. And then, of course, we all know what happens when we make those kind of promises. While I lived at home, I didn't pick up alcohol alcoholically. When I moved away to college, moved to Washington, D.C., that's when I really started to drink alcoholically. I had a job in a club. I was a cocktail waitress. And it was a really, like, hip club in D.C. It was, like, one of the first acid jazz lounges in D.C. So I felt like, you know, I was 18 years old, and I had this great job as a cocktail waitress, you know, and I was so cool, and all my friends wanted to get into the club, but it was, like, a locked-door club, and they couldn't get in. So I felt like, you know, I had arrived moment. I felt so cool. And so, you know, I would hang out after hours. I would drink. And I always had access to alcohol while I was there. And people would tip me in alcohol and drugs. And I had whatever I wanted, you know. I felt like it didn't matter. I didn't care. I was completely selfish. I didn't care about anybody else, you know. And when I drank, I would get violent. So it wasn't really a great combination to be a waitress, get violent while you're drunk and, you know, drink. So I would always get into trouble. You know, I was always into trouble. So one of the last times that I ended up, one of the really bad times, was when someone called me a name, one of my customers, and I decided to follow her out and take care of the problem. And my way of taking care of the problem, and this isn't, you know, to be funny, but I pushed her down the stairs. Nothing happened to her, but it turned out that she was a lawyer. So it's like we always pick these, like the trouble we get into, you know, I mean, it's only us, only alcoholics would do something like that, you know, push a lawyer down the stairs. Not good. So I pushed the lawyer down the stairs, and she wants me arrested. She wants me arrested for assault. So I didn't go back to the job, you know, because then they couldn't get me. And I walked around in fear, like, you know, I was completely in fear in the college campus where the cops were coming by, and I was like, hide behind a tree, like, with no leaves on it. You know, like, I was completely fearful. So nothing happened. I don't know how, but nothing happened. I was lucky. Nothing happened. And there's no warrant out for my arrest. I know that, too. So I was lucky, you know. And I got fired from the job. And so I decided that I'd get another job. And, you know, no other job worked for me but working in a bar. I couldn't do anything else, really. You know, I tried an office thing, and that was like, that just didn't help me at all. The restaurant with a bar helped me, you know, to deal with life. Because alcohol, like Arisa was saying, was my solution. You know, I'm not well equipped to deal with life without alcohol, or for that matter, this program. So I would, you know, my drinking started to escalate, and I would work, and as soon as I got into work, you know, I usually tried not to drink until I got to work, and so as soon as I got to work, the bartenders knew that they would give me a drink before I even said a word to anybody. It would be waiting for me. So I'd walk in, have my drink. They're like, oh, we know not to talk to you unless you've had a drink, you know. And I remember what I would do is try to stay in a straight line. Like, I would try to walk in a straight line. That was my job, bringing a check to the table, try to walk in a straight line. And then I knew I was okay. When I swerved, then I was in trouble. I knew I was in trouble. So I would just drink the whole night, you know. And then go out after part after hours. I was always at an after hours. And my apartment, I lived in a studio apartment in college, and I had so many windows. It was a really beautiful place. You could look out the window and see the Washington Monument. And, I mean, it was a to-die-for apartment. It was gorgeous. But I nailed comforters to the wall, so they hung over the windows, so no light could come in. You know, my house was the after hours, so I never wanted any light to come in. You know, and I'd wake up when it was, you know, 2 p.m. And I got through college. I really don't know how I did it, but I know that I was drunk through most of my classes, or, you know, on other substances through most of my classes. But I did graduate college, and you know, I just got progressively worse. And the person I was dating at the time said that he was going to tell my mom if I didn't tell her that I had a drinking problem. And let me give you another introduction to my mother. My mother is from an Irish Catholic family of 8, and she was a nun for 17 years. So you don't ever double-cross my mom. So I did not want him telling my mom anything. I needed full control of that situation. So I went ahead and said, oh, you know, in a moment of weakness, I said, Mom, I think maybe, you know, I have some trouble with alcohol. And she said, okay. And this was as I was about to graduate college. And she said, okay, so what do you want to do? And I was like, well, someone said something about a meeting. Maybe I could do that when I get home or something. You know, and again, it was in a moment of weakness, because I really think that's the only time we're able to ask for help is when we're really downtrodden, when we're in a really bad place, and life starts to look hopeless. And that was a moment for me. So, you know, my family lives in upstate New York in Albany. So I graduated and went home to my parents' house. And that same night, it must have been like the second night, my mom said, "Okay, so we're going to a meeting." And I'm like, we, you know, and so what happened was, so I located a meeting, and I told my mom the address, and it was in the evening. And so my mom was making dinner, she had everything all ready, and I'm like, the meeting was at 7 o'clock, 6:45, and I'm like, yeah, she forgot about it. You know, we're eating dinner at 6:45, and I was so excited because I wasn't going to have to go to the meeting. And then tick-tock, 5 minutes to, my mom's like, oh my goodness, let's go, it's the meeting. She gets me in the car somehow. We get in the car, we get to the meeting, and, you know, we don't know how to walk in. We're 15 minutes late at that point. And my mother's first, she goes first, and I'm second, and we walk in the door, and there's basically 90% men, all over the age of maybe 80, all over the age of 80. And there is probably one tooth collective in the room. And so I was, you know, I felt a little bit out of place. And at the end of the meeting, someone said, you know, is there anyone new at this meeting? Looked directly at me. And I'm like hysterical crying. I'm lobster red, so embarrassed, so nervous. And my mom raises her hand. My mom's not an alcoholic at all. And my mom raises her hand and she said, I just want to say how beautiful it is that you all share. And I just think it's such a wonderful place. And I'm like, okay, never, never again am I, number one, bringing my mother anywhere. Number two, never ever am I coming back here. And someone comes up to me after the meeting, a female came up to me after the meeting and said to me, you know, there's another meeting tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. and there's some younger people there. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to go. I'm like, oh, thank you, sure. And so I don't know you know, what happened, but after that I decided I would bring my brother instead of my mom, because I wasn't going to go to a meeting alone, you know, that wasn't going to happen. So I decided to bring my younger brother with me. Now, let me tell you, this is the moment of clarity for me that I knew I was an alcoholic. I got home that night, and everybody had gone to sleep in the house, and I had this brilliant idea that I should have a drink. So I went downstairs to their cabinet. At this point, they were smart. They understood. They had hidden all of the alcohol, except for this crusty old bottle of peach schnapps that I found. I undid the top and crust fell down, poured myself a drink, and I took the drink. I said that out loud. I sighed out loud. And I knew that at that moment, I had a drinking problem. I was an alcoholic. You know, I knew. And I didn't know what I was going to do about it, but I knew. And so the next morning I woke up, and my brother and I went to the meeting. And I decided I'd go to meetings, and that was, you know, I didn't take a drink after that time, but I decided, you know, I'm going to give this a try. I'll go to meetings, and, you know, I ended up going to a bunch. I had a home group. I had two sponsors. I made cookies at one of my mother made cookies at one of my meetings as my service commitment, you know, like, and never mind, like, yeah, I wanted it to be the best meeting ever, and I knew that she was a much better baker than I was, so I was going to make it, you know, I wanted everybody to come to this meeting because I made the cookies, get all the credit, but my mother made the cookies. And, you know, lemon bars, they were really good. That's what she made. and so I did that. And then I, you know, wasn't totally fulfilled. I just did that and it was fine. And then I got a job. Let me tell you also, during that whole time, you know, I didn't drink, but I did other substances. And I thought I was sober. You know, I really thought I was sober. And it took me a long time until I got into AA, in the middle of AA, to learn what being sober really meant. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. So I wasn't really sober. I would also drink non-alcoholic beer, O'Doul's. And O'Doul's has a little bit of alcohol in it, a very, very minute amount. Thank you. And so I would drink enough O'Doul's to get a little buzz. And I'd have to pee every 2 seconds, but I would drink enough O'Doul's, you know, to get a little buzz. So I ended up moving to the city. I got a great job, and I got a job at NBC, and I was, you know, I was a page. I thought, you know, again, I was doing so well for myself. You know, I got into this, like, very competitive work, and I was really excited. And so I went to New York, I came here, and I picked up a drink within 2 months. I didn't go to meetings when I got here. And so when they talk about, and I know a lot of people have said this, but when we talk about picking up at a much lower bottom than where we left off, that's what happened for me. So now it wasn't enjoyable drinking. So for me, I was drinking in my house. I was hiding bottles. I lived alone, but I was hiding bottles, and, you know, I just... that is, yeah, I was hiding bottles when people came over, but not for myself. So I was hiding, and so, yeah, so, you know, I was drinking alone, and I was drinking, and I was always trying to find people to go out with me and stay out all night, and I'd have drinks during the day at lunchtime, you know, and advertising, that's just, it's not so uncommon. So for me to have a couple drinks at lunchtime, it was fine. You know, and then I'd pull everybody. Happy hour was my favorite time of day, because that was the time where I just started to get that really nice buzz, and then I felt okay, you know, and then I didn't remember the rest of the night, so I couldn't tell you if I enjoyed it or not. But, you know, I loved happy hour. So, you know, it stopped working. I got into this really bad place, and what happened was that I went to Washington, D.C. to visit friends, and I went into a 4-day blackout. I don't really remember what happened. Came back, and I started to have this, like, overwhelming sense of panic. And I didn't realize that I was going through, I had the DTs. I didn't realize what was happening to me because I had started to withdraw from alcohol, and I guess I had never been away from alcohol for very long. So I started to have the DTs, and I was filled with panic, and, you know, I was really, really, really... scared. I don't know what of, but I was petrified of life. So I stayed home from work, and I sat in my apartment. I didn't sleep. I didn't do anything. I called my mom at 2 a.m, hysterically crying, and my mom said, you know, maybe let's pray. So I prayed, and she said after that, you know what you have to do. I'm like, no, what? And she's like, you need to go back to AA. And so I wasn't convinced, but, you know, I went to work the next day, and I ended up having a complete nervous breakdown. Let me tell you, I was very delusional. So not only was I afraid in the middle of the night, but I was afraid I was going to be possessed by the devil. Something horrible was going to happen to me. I was, like, nuts, hiding, like, in the corner of my apartment. I was really crazy. And I go to work the next day because I don't know what else to do, and I have a nervous breakdown. I can't function. And a coworker of mine takes me to the employee assistance program at my job. And I'm like, I just need a sleeping pill. Just give me a sleeping pill. And they're like, oh, no. Sit down, and we're going to give you something else. And they gave me Stephanie. So, you know, they said, can someone from AA call you? And that's when I get this phone call. And Stephanie says, can you meet me at a meeting? It was a Friday night. And I said, yes. And she tells the story better than I do because I really don't remember. She says I come out of the subway smiling, walking down the street. That was not how I felt at all. But I come down and I meet her and I go to a meeting and I followed her everywhere, you know, she said to go for that first week. It seemed like forever, but I followed her everywhere. You know, I knew at this point I had hit bottom. I had nowhere else to go and I was completely hopeless. I had nothing left. And so I would have said, yes, whatever you tell me to do, I'll do. So then, again, I meet Arisa. And Arisa, when she first took me to this meeting, the first night I came, I read the steps. I remember that. But afterwards, I cried. I was so upset because no one talked to me. It was such a big group. And Arisa left me to go do her commitment, and I was really upset that she didn't stand by my side and baby me and, you know, take care of me because it was so overwhelming, you know, and I cried the whole way home with a resentment, and what I learned is that's not exactly how it works, you know. Arisa taught me to jump into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, after she said yes to sponsor me, she asked me to call her. She asked me to do some reading and then call her the next day. And so I said, what time? And she said, I'm awake very early. So I call her. Again, I'm not sleeping. I call her at 6 a.m. the next morning, Saturday morning. And I'm like, hi, good morning. Are you awake? And she's, you know, she wasn't awake, but she said she'd take my call. And she went over these questions that she had me do, and she read with me in the big book at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, and that's the dedication that I learned that, you know, that we have here. The dedication to the newcomer, to helping somebody else through the pain that we've suffered, you know, as alcoholics. And so, you know, she pushed me to do the steps. And so we did 2 and 3, and I got a resentment in 3. So we're going, you know, she told me that I had to do, I had to go to all these activities, right? So I went to apple picking. That was the only activity we had at that time, apple picking and pumpkin picking, right? And I think there were probably like, maybe 15 of us who went, and Vince and Bonnie were always there, and then Arisa was there, and Peggy was there, because I think I still have pictures. So I should bring them for you guys sometime. So, you know, we're all on the hayride, and I got a resentment because I was supposed to do my third step with Arisa, and she's meeting with another sponsee. And I was so upset about this. Like, how could she? You know, so what I started to learn was patience and that I'm not the center of attention. There are other people in this universe, you know. So we ended up doing my third step here in the back of the church. And she turns to me, and this is what she tells me her sponsor did to her. So it's kind of a joke, but it wasn't really. And she's like, did you feel it? You know, after we did the third step. And I'm like, maybe, you know, I don't know. And so we did it again. And then I left the church and I did feel it that time. I felt that like lightness of being. For the first time ever, I felt like a part of this group. I felt like I was in action and I was like just one of everybody. you know, and it was such a beautiful feeling. And so, you know, she instructed me how to do the fourth step with the four columns. And that took a while. Now, let me tell you something else. Arisa's not one to be messed with. It seems like I have these running themes in my female relationships. She's not one to be messed with either. So she taught me how to do this fourth step, right? And so you did what she asked. You did. And there are some days I didn't, and I got an earful. But I really learned how to be a woman of dignity and grace, someone to show up, to commitments, to show up. And I don't do this perfectly today, but I understand when I'm wrong, and I can make amends for when I'm wrong, when I, you know, act out of character, out of who I would want to be. So Arisa did the fifth step with me, and what she did was she sat down every Saturday. She taught an art class in New Jersey, and she'd drive me out to New Jersey, and we would read the fourth step in the middle of this, like, it was an independent study type thing. So she would spend time with me, and then she'd have to run out at times. But we did this over, like, months, I think. It seemed like it. She's laughing. I mean, it seemed like years to me. But we did, because she's like, she'd comment, you know, and we'd talk about everything. We would talk about everything that I had on that list. And so when I had finished that fifth step, again, I had a feeling of being a part of. And I couldn't wait to get into 8 and 9 at that point. You know, and I was fearful, and everybody says they're fearful of doing a ninth step. But there, you know, the steps really are in order for a reason. And when you get to 9, you're ready. You're ready. And I was ready. And so, this is going to make me cry also. But, you know, one of the first amends I did was to my parents. So we happened to be on a family vacation in the Caribbean. And you know, I told my parents, I asked them if I could do this with them during this time, would it be okay? And I set up a little, like, conference area on the beach to the side in the shade. And I had my mom and I had myself, two chairs. And I said, okay, Mom, can you come over? And so I made the amends to my mom. And, you know, I have a fantastic relationship with her today. It was not always that way. We had difficulty when I was out there, of course. But we have such a great relationship. So then she said, okay, yes, absolutely, I forgive you, I love you, and should I call your father over now? And I said, yes, please. And so she went, and she got my dad, and my dad sat down next to me, and I said, thank you. And I said to him, and he said to me, I did my amends, and I said, Dad, I am asking for your forgiveness. And he said to me, oh, God, he said, Kel, we forgave you the minute you did any of these things. We love you unconditionally. And, you know, like, I carried around a lot of pain, the things I caused my family and my friends and people around me. And to know that people loved me and forgave me was huge. So I got to hold my head up a little bit higher each time I did these amends. So, you know, what it also allowed, like I said, it allowed me to have the most beautiful relationship with my family today. You know, and I have a younger brother, and he trusts me and loves me as well. And I, you know, it's some of the other things, the gifts I've received in sobriety. I was able to go back to school. So not only did I go to school for a second bachelor's in nursing, but I went to school from my master's in nursing. So I'm a nurse practitioner today, and I can write prescriptions, which is crazy, crazy to me. You know, like, I can't imagine being able to do that. You know, I have that. I'm able to treat people, to reach my hand out to other people. So part of what I learned in AA is to give myself to other people. And, you know, I love my job. I work with pediatric hemophilia patients and blood disorders. And it's a really, and I did heart transplants for babies as one of my other jobs, you know, and like, I can't imagine a more fulfilling life than what I have. And one of the really other beautiful things that's happened to me for this year is I got married, and my wife Kim is here also. And you know, like, I'm I'm really lucky, first of all. I'm really lucky. You know, she's somebody that understands AA, and she makes an effort. And she puts up with me when things aren't always easy. And that's something that I feel completely blessed to have in my life. I just can't say thank you enough to AA. I wouldn't even be able to put it into words. I can't say thank you enough to my higher power, whom I continue to seek and find a bigger relationship with. And I just can't say thank you enough to the Atlantic Group and to Peggy and Van. Thanks.